Today's date is Wednesday, the 13th of January, 2016. The interviewer is Carol Shepherd. Can you tell me your name, please?
Christopher Wardale.
And could you spell your name, please?
W-A-R-D-A-L-E.
Thank you. Can I ask for your date and place of birth?
11-7-46, Stokesley in North Yorkshire. Mm.
Today's interview is being recorded at, what's your address?
24 Beechcroft, Kenton Road, Newcastle upon Tyne.
For the Christian Voices Coming Out project. Okay, Chris, I wonder if you could begin by telling me about where you grew up, any siblings, what your parents did, that kind of thing.
Single child, brought up on the North Yorkshire coast in a tiny little Victorian seaside resort called Saltburn by the Sea. Father ran a bus company, mother was a teacher. I did a sort of fairly ordinary schooling in my young years, much to everybody's surprise. I passed the 11 plus and went to the grammar school, which for the next 7 years I absolutely loathed. Then went off to university, got a degree in fine art, went and restored medieval stained glass in York Minster. Finally realised a vocation that had been lurking around for a lot of years. When I got to the age of 30, thinking if I wasn't going to do it, it was going to be too late. Went off and tested it, and much to my surprise, and I think God's, ended up with the dog collar on. So.
Is that the Anglican Church?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Talk to me. Did you have brothers or sisters?
No.
You're an only child?
Yes.
Okay. Would you say you had a living faith when you were a child?
I had a church faith. Church became the sort of the place I went to. Mm. I was never very good at sort of things like youth clubs and Cubs, Scouts, things like that. They weren't really for me at all. But church was great because there were things to do. And I started serving at a remarkably early age and got involved with all the myriad bits of things that there are to do in and around a church and a church vestry. So, and that became, as it were, my little club.
Mm.
That was the place I went to, and nobody seemed to mind very much. It was nobody complained, so it was all right. And I spent quite a lot of time there and got to know people very well. And I was always better with adults really than I ever was with other children.
Mm.
I seem to relate much better to them.
Yeah. Do you think this was because you were an only child?
I can't really answer that question because I never knew what it was like to have brothers or sisters. I may have been a very different person, or there we go, I may not have been.
Okay.
So I don't know really.
Okay. When did you first become aware of your sexuality and a sexual identity?
It was somewhere during school, in secondary school, as everybody else got terribly, terribly interested in girls. I got terribly interested in drama. and there were...
Drama the subject.
Drama the subject. Drama the
not
subject.
Not being a diva.
Yeah, it's not being a diva. Oh, I could be a diva. I could be a diva. And then it began to it began to dawn on me, and I think as always happens with adolescents, you think you're the only one in the world.
Yeah.
And nobody else would know, and they'd all have a fit and faint and all the rest of it. So I don't think I ever did anything about my sexuality apart from having discovered what a hand could do and what pleasure it could give.
Mm.
Never really did anything about sexuality until I went to university and came here to Newcastle.
Hmm.
Which was only 60 miles away, but was an entirely different place. It was a foreign land. You'd cross three major rivers.
Yeah.
And you came to a place where they spoke a foreign language and they did things differently. And suddenly you could be almost who you wanted to be.
Did it have that big city feel then?
Yes, it well, for me it was a big city. Although it was actually a very small city. But it had the feeling of a big city. There were three theatres and umpteen cinemas and there were, you know, there was music and there was things to do and there were pubs galore and there was a gay pub.
Mm.
In fact, there were two in those days, which were all a bit secretive. And in some ways that made it even more interesting.
Mm.
Whereas now it's dead boring because there are so many gay pubs and nobody gives a toss, really.
Mm.
And it's mostly full of straight people because they, certainly straight women feel much safer in a gay pub than they do anywhere else,
yeah.
Especially in Newcastle on a Friday night.
What did you do at university?
Fine art.
Oh, yes. Stained glass.
Stained glass.
Yeah, that's right. And did you get involved in gay sock and things like that?
Oh, there wasn't a gay sock. Oh, there nothing wasn't. Like a gay sock, no. I mean, the one place you couldn't be gay was the university.
Okay.
Because either the medics or the agricultural students beat you up. You could be gay in town. That was all right within that particular group. But it wasn't. I mean, this was the middle 60s. And though we were all wearing flowers in our hair in the day when we had hair, and all the rest of it, being gay was still thought of something as very suspicious and all the rest of it.
And it was still illegal.
And still very illegal.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So what were you involved in at university as well as your fine art degree?
Very little. Very little, in fact. I didn't do politics. I took one look at the Christian Union and realised that they thought the Bible was literally true, and there really had been two people called Adam and Eve, and realised that really wasn't for me.
Mm.
And I began to discover that there were lots of other ways of doing Christianity than just the one I'd been brought up with at home, which had been very middle of the church. But you could kind of within the city centre itself, you could go from extreme Protestant Church of England to extreme High Church. Church of England, and this became fascinating. This became absolutely fascinating as I began to find and made friends in the churches. I had made friends at university, but they were people I worked with rather than people I ever went out drinking with. I did a lot of work in the Theatre Royal Moving Scenery, which fills in a couple of years, and then went to the old repertory company. I purely by chance met the guy who was the then designer, and he was looking for somebody to paint scenery, so I went and painted scenery. So weekends were taken up kind of working, really. So it wasn't a terribly social university life. It was a very busy university life, but not a particularly social one.
Mm. So, relationships, were they happening?
There were friendships, and there were anonymous sexual connections until my final year when I did meet someone purely by chance. I spilt a pot of paint over him when we were painting the set for Murder in the Cathedral. It seemed ironic in a way, and he was very cross. And I was very apologetic, and we went and had a drink afterwards, and that turned into a, though it was only, as it were, a one-to-one for the last 6 months before I moved and went off to work in New York. We were always friends, and indeed I did his funeral a couple of years ago, but we never stopped being friends.
Mm. So, you discovered your calling, and you went off and got a dog collar, as you put it.
Went off and got a dog collar.
How have you, during that time, did you reconcile your faith with your sexuality, publicly or privately, or?
by the late 60s, things had relaxed amazingly. There was a very large gay community in York, where I was living. And it wasn't just all squeezed into one particular pub. I got involved in a lot of theatre companies, and there again I was doing scenery for them and I was doing acting for them. So life became much, much, much more social. Made a lot of long-lasting friends, both sexual and otherwise. In those 8 years, and there was much more of a feeling. Yes, you had to watch your back. You didn't exactly kind of walk down the street burning your Calvin Kleins. Mm-hmm. Not that they'd been invented in those days. But there was much more of a feeling of coming out, and frankly, nobody cared anymore.
Okay.
And at college, and it, of course, it had bothered me, all the business about getting ordained, and oh God, the church roof would, you know, and when would the question come, was I gay? Because I was 30. I wasn't married. It was quite clear I wasn't married. And had never had particularly close women friends. I had a lot of women friends. And nobody ever asked the question.
Okay.
Ever. Ever. Every time I went for an interview with anyone, I thought, this is going to be the one. This is going to be it. This is. And am I going to be honest, or am I not going to be honest? I'd come out at work, and most people I got friendly with, sort of, they didn't care whether I didn't have to formally come out. Ever bother anyway. But I went through the whole process of selection, even at the formal interview, the 2 or 3 days you go away on, and those days called an album, and nobody asked the question. There was a lady from the Mothers' Union who sort of said, I realise you're single, Mr. Wardell, you'll wonder why there's an ironing board here, show me how you iron a shirt. So I did. And she said, that's a very interesting way of ironing a shirt. Who taught you how to iron? I said, my mother. And she said, how did you do the collar? So I showed her how to do the collar. She said, that's much better the way than I do it. Show me how to do it. So I taught her how to re-iron. And we talked about drama. And we talked about, she wanted to play for the Mothers' Union for Christmas. So I told her to do one. And then there was an interview, we talked all about cricket, about which I knew absolutely nothing. And the evangelical asked me, you're walking along the street and someone has a car accident. What would you tell the person who's been run over? What would you tell them about the cross? To which I said, I wouldn't actually tell them anything, I would do it. I'd ask them if they were serious, it was quite clear they were dying, did they want to make their confession and would they like a blessing? I wouldn't tell them about the cross, I'd make the sign of the cross. This had never dawned on them, apparently.
This is fascinating.
So I went away thinking, well, I've balls that up. I really have balls that up because nobody asked about, and nobody really talked about God, apart from the cross. And much to my surprise, the thing was I'd been accepted.
Do you, I mean, you think they know, but they just deliberately didn't ask you because they weren't forced into a decision?
Yes, they knew, but those were the days. It was rather like Bill Clinton's thing about the army.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, but nobody says anything. And it was very much the gentlemanly way that the Church of England decided on the people they felt they wanted.
So, do you think they would have treated another gay ordinand that they maybe thought weren't as gifted as you are differently?
Yes, that would be the excuse, as indeed it was the excuse.
Yeah.
Because there were other people who were gay.
Yeah.
And we'd swapped, and I ran round. And they'd been rejected because there were questions about their sexuality.
So they deliberately didn't ask you because they wanted you?
Yeah. I now know that in retrospect.
Yeah, but at the time.
But at the time, it all seemed very strange.
Yeah. So you were accepted and you did your initial training.
Went off to Murfield, to the monastery at Murfield.
Where's that exactly?
Outside Huddersfield, right. in West Yorkshire. Mm. High Church, very much the Catholic end of the Benedictine monastery, so there was all that sort of discipline of living, really, as monk. The college was in the grounds. You lived and worshipped with the brothers. And of course, I was much older than everybody else, because everyone else was going still in those days after university at 21, 22. So I was getting on for 10 years older than anybody else. And it was the first year that they'd had more than one or two mature students, as we were called. So you did the course in 2 years by essay rather than 3 years by exams. Mm-hmm. You did exactly as much work, but you did it in 2 years instead of three. But there were half a dozen of us. And we'd run businesses, we'd seen life and all the rest of it. And in many ways, we had quite an influence on the place because we asked questions.
Yeah.
We kind of laughed at the ethics teacher and said, "Have you ever been in a gay pub? Have you actually been in a prison?"
Yeah.
Because there was someone who had been a prison warder. So we took him here and we took him to the gay club in Huddersfield, where he seemed to enjoy himself rather more than I thought he was going to. But never mind. And there again, we stayed friends for lots and lots of years. And he finally became a bishop. And was happily married, children, all the rest of it. So those two years, yes, but there was never the great worry of having to sort of sort myself out and come to terms with all this thing. I'd done the biblical thing, I'd thought through all of that, but every time I kind of asked God the question, "So what about this?" the answer had never come down no. But there again, the answer never came down yes either. But there was never a sort of a turning away. Was the whole business of the vocation I felt simply part of my own delusions? And all the way through, it seemed to work.
Yeah.
And indeed, when it came to ordination, apart from one little hiccup where I thought I was going to the Diocese of York, but ended up in the Diocese of Durham. It all went all right, and the earth didn't move, and the cathedral didn't fall down when hands were placed upon me.
No darkness, no black curtains.
No, not at all. And in that sense, it was kind of worryingly ordinary. You know, there were the crises, as there always are in those things, and you have to. But it wasn't necessarily about the sexuality.
Yeah, yeah. So you then started a curacy.
Curacy for four. It was still the days when you had to do 6 years as a curate.
Okay.
3 years and 3 years.
Mm.
But because I was that bit older, I did 4 years in one place, and then went off and got a place of my own.
Hmm.
Which was just south of the river from here, in a place called Burdon Colliery.
Mm-hmm.
And Pitt Village, the pit had closed, and I got instituted on the second day of the miners' strike.
Okay.
So you were kind of in the middle of it.
Yeah.
They'd had 13 years of my predecessor, who they loathed. And in many ways, I could have been a gorilla with two hands behind my back. And they would have welcomed me, and it was wonderful to suddenly find yourselves in the middle of a community in a real community crisis.
Yeah.
And there was no money, and there was no food, and there was and it kind of makes today's austerity look positively generous. I mean, it really was awful. Just watch the film of Billy Elliot, and people are having Christmas dinner on beans on toast. I knew those people, and they burnt the piano. But the generosity, because if you had a tin of beans, you shared it with somebody.
I grew up in South Wales, so when I was a teenager, it was on the news in Wales the whole time. So I'm quite, aware of it. I bet you wished you could have dragged your ethics teacher there and said, look.
I did drag my then bishop, who had been professor of theology at Leeds, a man called David Jenkins, who turned out to be absolutely wonderful. He turned out to be the liberal that Margaret Thatcher agreed to and regretted, because he stood with the miners at the pit gates. He came and talked to people. He read something in the paper about that I'd released, that there was a family where there were three children and one pair of shoes, so the children only went to school one day, every third day. They took turns. And I said, this is true. I said, do you want to come and meet them? She said, I'm in the car. Go around and have lunch.
Yeah.
I took some sandwiches on. And he'd never been on a council estate in his life. And it just opened his eyes. And by that time, I'd met Malcolm. And we were relatively discreet, but it was you know, there were other gay men in Bolden Colliery, and it was all right, because it was so-and-so's lad. He was a nice lad,
yeah,
right, and he played rugby and he had his whippets and he grew his leeks and all the rest of it, so it was fine, right. And the only time it really hit me, well, it hit both of us, was having spent 8 years there. And it was just after there'd been one or two peculiarities in the General Synod in 88, where it was kind of a serious suggestion that anyone who knew themselves to be gay should resign their orders. And those, it didn't pass. It was a strongly felt thing. And that was the moment where it kind of really hit me. And having gone through this sort of fairly easy stage of minor crises, this was a real major crisis, and I spent all night in church. And I really didn't know what to do, and I rang David Jenkins up and I said, do you want my resignation? So he laughed and he said, don't be so bloody stupid. For goodness sake, I sat through all that. Don't be so bloody stupid. Grow up.
Ooh.
So I duly did. Then moved to another parish, which was next door to where I'd served as a curacy in Darlington. Huge, great church, small cathedral of a church, very middle class, very suburban. Tree-lined suburbia, which is not really my cup of tea at all. And it was quite clear, a lot of people remembered me, but the people then largely in charge hadn't known me. And it was quite clear when I went to make the PCC that I was not the easy pushover that they'd been used to. So they dug round to see if they could find any objections. Of course, gay.
Yeah.
Ah, straight in.
Yeah.
So we were outed in the press, and the world went crazy for about a week, and we invented the little tag that we've always kept to. We're middle class, we're middle aged, and we're as boring as hell. So within days the tabloids gave up. And then other bits of the press started taking us seriously, because we talked about the gay issue. He was still heavily involved with the LGCM.
Yeah.
I'd become attached to LGCM through him. We'd been mentoring other people who were having trouble about their sexuality and their vocations and things like that. We'd started a group for the younger gay clergy who by the late 90s were feeling particularly threatened after all the business of the Lambeth Conference in 1998. See big pictures of Richard Kirk on LGCM and the Bishop of Nigeria and all the rest of it. And that really kind of floored both of us. Because yes, we'd helped other people through with it, but it had never happened to us before. And that really was quite a surprise.
Yeah.
But the net result was that I could walk down the street not having to be schizophrenic anymore.
Yeah.
Because everybody knew,
yeah.
And Darlington didn't mind. And if Darlington didn't care...
yeah, you were pretty safe elsewhere.
You were pretty safe.
Yeah.
And I could actually walk down the street with my head up high, and I no longer had to have half a glance behind me as to who was listening to whatever I was saying.
Yeah.
And in the end, it was awful when it happened, but that kind of outing thing was an amazingly releasing thing. And I think in many ways made my ministry not more honest in a way, but much more outward looking.
Did you end up in that church then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The people who had organised the coup all left, but it was only six of them out of a congregation of 150.
Mm.
And I was told afterwards that they were very grateful to me because they'd been pains in the bum.
Oh!
I thought it was a very apt phrase, really. So I then spent 14 years there. And became... I mean, I was always very fond of Richard Kirk, although he was really our concern, but became my friend as well. Richard had this wonderful way of networking. He knew everybody.
Mm.
He knew absolutely everybody. And whenever he had need of you, bring you up. And after 1998, the number of Anglican clergy who were prepared to put their head over the parapet got less and less and less. Everybody got very frightened again. I mean, the banging of the closet door and the rattling of the chains on the inside became extraordinary again, just when he thought everything was moving coming out. And there were two of us who were prepared to talk to the press. One in East London and me in Darlington. So whenever anybody wanted a gay comment,
yeah,
it was me or Michael in East London. Michael then got frightened off by Richard Charteris because he was a priest in charge. And Richard Charteris told him quite firmly that if he ever spoke to the press again on the gay issue, he would have no job. So it ended up as being me.
Oh, okay.
So there were endless articles about this and that and comments and all the rest of it. Then I got a bishop when David Jenkins had retired, a new bishop arrived, who we discovered had been in court for having sex in a public toilet with a man.
Okay.
He was evangelical, happily married with several children.
Mm.
But he was outed by the News of the World.
Mm.
Yes. Mm. And I stood up in a door. He had a big clergy meeting in Auckland Castle, sort of saying, do you want me as your bishop or not? And I stood up and said, on behalf of the gay clergy of this diocese, of which there are now 44 members of us, we welcome you. We all know what you've been going through.
Yeah.
And the man was so embarrassed. He was so embarrassed because he'd never had anybody acted. He'd never, I don't think he'd ever spoken to a gay person. He wasn't gay. He really wasn't gay.
Mm.
He'd come off bad sex. And he was horrified by anyone who was out and sort of wasn't guilty and hadn't sort of publicly repented and all the rest of it. And by that time, I had for several years been on the Bishop's Council, the central grouping of a diocese between laity and clergy and the senior staff, and everyone respected what I had to say, and Michael Turnbull just didn't understand any of this because I was this strange person who seemed to be like a perfectly ordinary human being. And it got worse. George Carey was still Archbishop, who was homophobic. He was homophobic. And I got dragged to one side after Bishop's Council. He said, I need a pastoral conversation, which normally meant he had a problem with somebody else and would I sort it out.
Okay.
But this one was, I'm giving you a sabbatical. Sabbaticals were very common in those days. In public, it's a pat on the head. Well done, thou good and faithful servant, and you're ready for one in your right age. All the rest of it. Between you and me, I'm giving you 3 months' salary to go and find another job, which will have nothing whatsoever to do with the Church of England.
Okay.
Because you are an embarrassment to us all. I have tried to do everything I can to get you out of your living, and legally I can't. But I really don't want to work with you anymore, so you will come back after 3 months and send me a letter of resignation. Gee, thanks, I thought. So I went and had a ball. I went and everybody else did serious things for sabbaticals and they went and studied. And
yeah.
I went and had a ball. I had 3 months. I really enjoyed myself. Came back and wrote him a letter that in my sabbatical, in my trekking round Cappadocia, God and I had reconnected in a very new and real and positive way, and I was not resigning.
Yeah.
He was furious. I couldn't do anything about it because this was only a conversation between him and me. Mm. Nobody else knew about it. He was furious. And he tried very hard. He tried everything that he could. Wouldn't give me a new job. I wasn't allowed a license in the new place.
Mm.
And the thing was that if I decided to stay, there would be I couldn't move. I was on a blacklist, and I wasn't. I was a lie, an absolute lie. I was stuck where I was, and I thought, But curates kept coming. And I kept thinking, how strange it is. I am this person who is not fit to stand in front of people, talk to people, take their weddings, funerals, baptise their children, all the rest of it. But I can train curates.
Yeah.
You're actually putting the lives of these very vulnerable people. Mm. And you're trusting me. And I was very good at training curates, I must admit. I enjoyed training curates. Michael Turnbull retired, and then Mr. Wright came, Tom Wright came.
Mm.
Who should never have been a bishop. Mm. It was, as somebody rather cruelly said, he's not so much the Bishop of Durham as the author in residence who's mostly in absentia, which was true. He had no interest in the dances at all. And indeed was homophobic, and his wife certainly was. And by that time I didn't care anymore, and I just told him what I thought.
What year was this?
He came in 2003.
Mm.
And he really, it's just awful.
Mm.
And when civil partnerships came up, and we decided we would have ours on the first day.
Yeah.
December the 21st, 2005. So just celebrated our 10th anniversary. Not in the Diocese of Durham, but here in Newcastle, where the then bishop had done the I wish them well, but I don't know anything about it. Oh, line.
Okay.
We had it done not in a parish church, but in a chapel of ease, a peculiar, which is kind of called St Thomas's in the town centre, which though it doesn't have the same sort of connections or responsibilities of a parish church. It's a chapel in it, an Anglican chapel in it, so right, that had belonged to a hospital. And Tom couldn't do anything. We were dragged before him and sort of said how embarrassed he had been by it, and he had been publicly embarrassed about what had been in the press and all the rest of it, and threatened to sack me and all the rest of it. And I smiled sweetly and sort of said, it was the line of, do you not realise the harm you two will do to my national and international reputation? To which both of us, without looking at each other, closed our notebooks,
mm.
and sort of said, this isn't about us at all, is it? It's all about you.
Mm.
It's on you. And he never spoke to me again.
Mm.
The next year I was going to be 60. I was coming to the end of training one particular curate when we'd had a very good time. And I thought, I'm never going to get another one. And I shall just hang round for the next 5 years. I might as well retire now. Mm. So I did. I retired at 60.
2005.
We bought this flat in, Malcolm bought this flat in the late 80s, so this was home.
Yeah.
Because he was working in Newcastle and commuted up and down.
Yeah.
I commuted to Newcastle and he commuted to Darlington. So we had somewhere to go to. The home was set up. Moved in moved north into the Diocese of Newcastle, which a lot of people from Durham had already started doing. The tidal drift became
yes,
like a tidal wave of people moving north, and they were the gay clergy and the ones who were rather more liberal and all the rest of it. So I knew lots of people. And crossing the bridge, so in church house, was like coming to a place that smelt of fresh air.
Yeah.
With a bishop who remembered your name and your partner's name, even when you were totally out of context.
Yeah.
You'd find him in the market. Christopher, how's Malcolm? Give him my regards.
Yeah.
This was a new world.
Yeah.
Which I've not had since 1994 when David Jenkins had retired. And I have spent the last 10 years. How did they ever find time to run the parish?
Mm.
I mean, it's just been great because I have rediscovered all the things that I thought I always believed I had been ordained to do, instead of having to sit at a desk being managing other people's ministry.
Yeah.
So I did have, after all, a ministry of my own and was made very welcome in so doing it.
Yeah. What sort of things are you doing now, for example?
Oh, I rush around taking services where there's vacancies, people are sick on holiday, they want a guest
like
preacher.
A kind of
like it's like a locum.
Yeah, yeah.
I've attached myself to a big church in Jesmond where the vicar has just gone off to be the new Bishop of Grantham. So the ones of us who were left, our diaries have filled up remarkably. It's a big and very busy church. So life is very busy.
You're doing all the fun bits of it.
So I'm doing all the fun bits, and I don't have to sit on committees anymore, and I don't have to organise anything anymore. I go in, strut my stuff, and be very nice to people as you drink the Anglican coffee, and come home.
Yeah,
and it's great, and you get paid for it.
Sounds wonderful.
which is even nicer. You get paid for it.
Yeah.
So yes, he was taught. It was quite a shock. Retiring at 60, but I couldn't have worked with Tom Rice any longer. It wouldn't have been. Because I knew what had happened. I would have simply slid into a depression, quite frankly. And it was having Linda, that particular curate, around, because she was very bouncy. And I thought, life is just going to be awful without her. It's all going to be very lonely again, so I might as well go and enjoy myself.
Yeah.
So I did.
Yeah.
And have done. I'm sorry, that's very long and roundabout story.
That's fine. How would you describe yourself?
Astrologically, I'm Cancer, so I'm supposed to be sort of solid, dull, unmoving. And I suppose in many ways I am. I'm Yorkshire. I like my feet in the ground. I'm much more adaptable in my latter age than I think I was for the rest of my life. But I'm an outgoing sort of guy. I get on with people. I like people. I like talking to people. I like listening to people.
What terminology are you happy with to be described as? Do you like being called a gay man, a queer?
On those times, certainly I think the one and only time I had a standing ovation at the end of sermon was at LGCM in Newcastle, not long after, and it was when Stonewall put out that thing about lots of people, homosexuals, get over it, thing on the buses, and it was the anniversary of my ordination, and I preached on I was ordained as a gay man. Because I was called as a gay man. So I ended up with, I'm a priest, I'm a puff, get over it. And they all stood up and clapped. It's never happened before, and, it's, and I have to say it's never happened since.
You don't have a red t-shirt with...
Oh. Well, sort of, yes. I have a puff priest. But it doesn't bother me anymore whether anybody is... I am who I am.
Yeah.
And I happily talk about him.
Yeah.
And I've also got to go home, the other half is waiting. Oh, how is she? It's a he.
Yeah.
And nobody faints anymore.
No.
I mean, yeah, there's Mr. Holloway and all the rest of it at Jessamine Parish Church, which, you know, and all those things that they get involved in, and they're deeply, deeply anti-gay, because the Bible tells them to be.
Yeah.
But that's a church that's kind of removed itself from all the systems. It simply runs its own show.
Mm.
And we have nothing to do with it. Mm. We always used to get into arguments on the radio. And in the end, we said there was no point in, because they either got David Holland away, or there was another guy down by the river who was the other evangelical who was anti-everything, to do radio interviews. And I said there was no point because they simply trotted out the same stuff over and over again, whereas we were moving on, we were relating to the world. It was just the Bible says, therefore it is wrong. They were pointless interviews.
I mean, I think one of the frustrations, certainly for me, is that they're willing to be challenging and questioning and theologically rigorous about other issues, but when it comes to sexuality, it's almost a kind of infantile unwillingness to apply the same rigour to that as they would to other areas.
And they will ask you all the questions, but will not answer any of the questions, except quote the Bible.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure they have mixed fabric clothing on. And eating.
Precisely. I did point that out.
We don't
to
see
one
the,
of them once, but
we don't see people outside prime.
Wearing a cotton polyester shirt.
Yeah.
And was on his third marriage.
What would be your proudest achievement in your life so far?
Professionally.
Anything you like.
Professionally training 7 curates. Six and a half, really, if you want to be technical. We'll call it 7. And I'm setting people off on the ministry of giving them a base and helping them to find themselves. Personally, finding him and living 31 years with him. And
it's a long time.
We look at each other and think, did we ever see each other? But we're still together.
Yeah.
But we're still together. And of that I am deeply, deeply proud.
It's a big achievement.
As we watch friends and family, they marry, they divorce, they marry, they divorce. All my first cousins are on at least their third marriage.
Mm. What makes your relationship work so well?
I think because we remain independent people who are in a relationship, and we know the boundaries where if he's off busy with his committees and things like that, well, those are important in his diary, and I don't argue about that, and he does that same with me, and in that sense we respect each other's diaries, and we always have done.
Yeah.
We are two individuals, but in fact we are together. Professionally, we are two individuals, but personally we are a couple.
Yeah.
And I think that was why the civil partnership was so important, much more than the marriage business.
Have you done the marriage business?
Because if I marry, I will have my license to officiate removed.
Of course, yeah.
And they haven't sorted the pensions out yet. And we had all gone very quiet.
Mm.
So it was the civil partnership, and it was all the business to do with kinship and all that. Those for us were the important bits.
Okay.
That we were recognised as a couple,
yeah.
And we were next of kin.
Yeah.
Now, we're both, as you discovered from him, he's a single child as well, and we were well into our 60s before the last parents died.
Yeah.
So we did remarkably well.
And you've got a cruise coming up.
And we've got a cruise coming up on Monday. Yes, this is kind of... We have no one to leave it to, so we're spending the inheritance.
We could leave it to Battersea Dogs Home or something.
Mm.
I think I'd rather go on a cruise.
Oh, I think LGCM, if it still exists when we die, will benefit quite well from it.
Okay, I won't bump you off as a trustee. With
there you are, fine. yes, various churches and charities will do very nicely indeed.
Yeah, LGCM's really picked up again, so
cool.
I hope we'll still be around.
Cool.
Yeah, how are we doing? Okay. If you could think of any things that we haven't touched on that for you have been significant, either in your walk with God or LGBT rights or...
The great disappointment, I think, was having watched him when we met in 84. Now LGCM was, you know, 8 years old already. It was forming, it was emerging, it was struggling. And to watch it grow, to watch it become a real force in the nature of not just making all things gay respectable, but making them possible. And other people linking into LGCM and seeing LGCM as really one of the things.
Mm.
And how that kind of moved on and was accelerating all the way through the 90s until 98, where kind of everything collapsed again.
Yeah.
And everybody and all the evangelicals were being said, oh, well, we must have meaningful conversation, but we must go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And instead of moving forward, we were going backwards. And the last 10 or so years has a real feel of that we've been going, certainly in the church, we've been going backwards rather than forwards. And
1998 Lambeth was clearly.
It was the 1998 Lambeth.
Entirely pivotal in all that.
Yes, I think it was because the gay issue took over, which wasn't really on the agenda, and it caused the schism about which they, as we talk, they are sitting down arguing about in Lambeth at the very moment, at the same moment.
Yeah, I find it quite ironically amusing that David Bowie. Dying, part of his life a professed bisexual man stole the headlines away.
What?
It was kind of like when Diana died the day that Mother Teresa died.
It was
that feeling of, I don't know, to me it felt ironic and vaguely amusing.
But I think the one disappointment is that the whole gay thing has moved on, but there have been those bits of society which have very carefully decided not to move it on, particularly in the church of all denominations, apart from the URCs and some other sort of the fringer ones. Even the Methodists have moved on amazingly, but the Anglican Church and the Roman Church seems to have just got stuck with this, and it's become a problem. Rather than recognising that gay people are a huge asset, we've become a problem.
Mm.
And somehow they've kind of got to put up with this.
So just damn it refuses to go away.
And damn it refuses to go. And why can't these people go and live on an island?
Yeah. What do you see as the future of the Church of England? To me, that it just feels like there can't be a middle ground anymore. It's you have to be LGBT affirming or you have to be...
Or you're not. You can't ignore
it
anymore.
Fudge it anymore.
I think the thing that surprised the Roman Church and the Anglican Church was that the vast majority of people who called themselves members of those churches approved of same-sex marriage. And in the latter year, there was an interview about... the referendum and same-sex marriage in Ireland, and someone deeply academic sort of said, who ever have thought it would have been homosexuality which united the Republic of Ireland in such a strongly Catholic country? And I think that's why both the Roman Church and the Anglican Church begin to realise that they have moved as institutions onto the edge of society, and they're not in the middle of them anymore.
Mm.
And they have to rediscover them, because it's not just that, it's suddenly they realise that it's other things as well that they haven't taken on, or they've seen as a problem. Now, the Anglican Church always had the thing was, whatever the world did, the Anglican Church would take 30 years to take it on, like abortion, yeah. Divorce.
It's a bit like hairstyles in Swansea, like hairstyles. Where I grew up.
And like I said, in 92, I did a seminar at the University of Newcastle, which there was David Holloway, and then there's another guy from round by the river whose name I've instantly forgotten. And I was talking about marriage and saying marriage will change. Marriage is not necessarily going to be one-to-one for life. It may be an ongoing contract. It may still be one-to-one, but it may not always be man and woman. To which they jumped and said, but the Bible says, and all the rest of it. I said, well, no, we have divorce. What does the Bible say about divorce? Oh, well, it's wrong because the Bible says, and, you know, this is the ultimate, and you can't argue against the Bible. They said, will you see same-sex marriage? When will it happen? I said, it will happen in my lifetime. I won't go any further than that. 10 years earlier than I thought it was going to be. And why the hell was it David Cameron who pushed it? Why did the Tories push it through? Of all the things for the Tories to push through so quickly and so unpreparedly, what on earth motivated them to do it? I can't imagine. Anyway, that's another life. But I think it's the way that the two major churches have quite deliberately from the inside manoeuvre themselves onto the edges rather than being in the middle. And I think that's one of that's my real profession and indeed gay disappointment.
Yeah.
Was the fact that we've gone in the last almost 20 years we've gone backwards rather than forward.
Yeah. Would you say the Church of England is bordering on being seen as almost disreputable by swathes of society?
I think it's not so much. If he was disreputable, it would be noticed. I think it's just unnecessary.
Yeah.
It sees itself as unnecessary. You don't have to get married in the church anymore. You don't have to do all those social things like having your child baptised, or you don't have to have a clergyman for a funeral anymore, clergy person for a funeral anymore. And there are all these very nice buildings, and it's nice to go to a carol service and things like that, but what's it for? And the Romans are finding much the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a few more minutes left. What do you... Thinking about all the prominent people who have now changed their tack and come out in favour of same-sex relationships, thinking of Steve Chalk, Rob Bell in America, Vicky Beeching, etc. Do you feel that there's almost a move of the spirit happening in society, in the church?
I've never been terribly comfortable with phrases like a move of the spirit. It's just not my language. And it's never been particularly part of my tradition as such. I'm too old-fashioned Anglican. On the one hand, I hope it is something like that. Now, I'm being Anglican, you see, on the one hand. If that's what it is, I am delighted, even if I don't quite understand what that might be. On the other hand, my cynical, grumpy old man hand says that it's amazing how convenient the churches can be when they can spot an audience. And rather like politicians suddenly found the influence and the power of the pink vote and the pink pound.
Yeah.
And is this institutions realising that there is a huge amount of their congregations always have been gay, And they really got to do something about either keeping them or winning some more of them. And then put all these things about, but of course you can't get ordained and you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't. Which is why, of course, I think in all these managed conversations we've had about sexuality, all the papers had nothing to do with any conversations with gay people. I got invited to go on behalf of this diocese and we were away. We'd already booked in for a conference, so I couldn't go. But the people who did it, and lots of people, you know, Colin Cowden and all the rest of it, has always argued that gay people wouldn't go to it because if you outed yourself, the evangelicals would report you to your bishop. Mm-hmm. So there was still that level of fear. On the one hand, you want them in the pews, but we're still not really good enough to have hands laid on us.
Yeah.
Though I think that is changing. And I am surprised by just in that sense how liberal and non-contentious Justin Welby has been on the gay issue, and indeed is muttering things about our history with the gay issue is a disgrace.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Mm.
So maybe things are turning. For America, the church is a business as much as any other business.
Yeah.
I fear. And I think that's the great strength of having two, as it were, established churches, though the only Anglican one really is established, but having two churches which are, as it were, very much at the heart of a nation, which is where they should be in dealing with absolutely everybody, but in fact have both for internal rows, have become apparent to the centre that they don't belong anymore.
Mm.
And it will be very hard to win them back.
Yeah.
And it won't just be gay people to win back, but to win anybody back, because people have realised you can actually live without them.
Yeah. Yeah. I have three children, two of them are teenagers, and that's complete anathema to them. Mm. You know, as teenagers, I identify as straight, but fully supportive of friends who are LGBT and... And I just have no idea why anyone would want to be involved. So
yes, we still have friends. The one thing that both straight friends and gay friends, and the great objection is not that we're gay, but that we're Christian. That's the thing they find really repellent.
Yeah, that's far more disreputable these days.
Much more disreputable these days, and to be a priest. good God, you know, kind of sort of we're. You know, you find yourself introduced. Oh, have you met Christopher? He's a vicar, you know, but he's quite nice.
It's almost that I'm a Christian with a proviso that I've talked about this with a few people, that because of the connotations of saying you're a Christian in society these days, you find yourself prefacing it in some way. And I mean,
yes.
I'm someone that will say I'm a left-wing Guardian reading Christian because I so don't want anyone to think I'm fundamentalist. And that's sad, really.
Yes. Yes, if we have a prophetic voice, it's Giles Fraser.
Mm.
Don't always agree with him. But he's like John the Baptist, and he says things which I don't think you're supposed to agree or disagree, but he just sort of wakes you up.
Yeah.
But he's moved to Friday rather than Saturday, but never mind.
just to close... if you were having a headstone made up for yourself, what three adjectives would you have on it to describe yourself?
Oh, heavens. Oh, good gracious.
good gracious.
Good gracious. I told you I was ill. I really don't know, because that's the one thing I won't do. I won't write my headstone. But I think if I was to leave instructions, I don't know. Whatever. I've never even thought of that. No,
okay.
I wouldn't know. I really wouldn't, you know. I hope it would be. I think somebody at my funeral will say, despite everything, he was really quite a nice guy.
Despite everything. Thank you very much for your time, Chris.
Really appreciate it. Well, I didn't ask you what the project you were talking about. What is the project? What's it for? What are you going to do with all this information you're gathering?